Everybody.
Chodesh Tov. Kislev. Presents. Latkes. It's all good. All right, so just a couple of reminders in terms of just bookkeeping things. So there won't be class for the next 2 weeks. I'm going to England next Thursday night for a conference, and then the following week I'll be in Israel with visiting my daughter. So I'll see you in the first Thursday of December, which will give you plenty of time to find a copy of Herzl's bad utopian novel, Old New Land. It is actually available online for those of you who don't mind reading things online. If you check out, I think it's called the Jewish Virtual Library, and you Google in that or alongside of that Old New Land, the entire thing is up there. So you could, you know, print it out and read it for yourself. I neglected to bring, although I'll send around a copy just to give you a sense of what it looks like. I think I had mentioned some time ago that it came out in 1960 as a kind of coffee table book by this well-known publishing company called Haifa Publishing Company. So this is really the edition of choice for reasons that you'll see when you take a look at it. Just what I mentioned, that they had basically sort of animated the book in terms of the kind of an annotation via images from the really subsequent Jewish history, so it's a kind of a, you get a sense of the novel, you get a sense of the way the Israelis portrayed it themselves in the context of Jewish history, you get a sense of Israel in 1960. So you can find this Amazon, abooks.com, the 1960 edition. This is the first chapter. So, you know, again, you can find it in a very inexpensive paperback or that one. That's obviously much more expensive, but it's a fun, for those of you who like to collect books, that's terrific. So that's it for next week, or for next session, I should say. And I guess that's all the logistical stuff I have to say about that. Tonight, we are talking about the first Aliyah, generally, and we'll spend a lot of time with Leon Pinsker's essay, Auto-Emancipation. Try to get a sense both through the essay, but also through some of the documents in this book, Origins of Israel, what this actually looked like on the ground, right? In other words, this is the first time, in effect, as a group, we're studying both a set of intellectual problems and solutions generated by figures like Pinsker, as well as getting a sense of Zionism as a kind of a living, breathing social phenomenon in terms of people trying to make things happen, going on Aliyah, wrestling with what that meant, succeeding, failing, trying again, engineering, re-engineering, all that stuff. So we'll sort of divide our time between the social story of Aliyah 1 and the intellectual story of what these people actually thought they were doing. And hopefully those things will not feel too disparate for you. So before we jump into that, let's just summarize what we talked about last time in terms of these proto-Zionist folks, right? We didn't talk about Hess. We'll spend a few minutes talking about Hess now. Hertzberg calls them precursors. Alkali, Kalischer. What's going on? What should we remember about these folks? These pre-Zionist type, precursor folks. What are some of the key points? Yeah, John.
Hess would say he was prescient.
Prescient.
Yeah.
Meaning?
He
I mean, I know what that word means.
No, he flipped on what happened in the, you know, 100 years later.
Yeah. Who are you talking about? Hess. Before we get to Hess, you're absolutely right. Let's talk about Alpaline and Kalischer just to make sure we are on the same page in terms of what we talked about last week. What are some of the key pieces of them? Yeah, Nancy?
They still kind of that, although they didn't believe in divine intervention, they still kind of back to redemption. There was a religious...
Correct.
There was a religious overtone to their Zionism.
Right, content and style.
Right, that's fabulous, right? That their content is very Jewy. They're rabbis.
The form is very Jewy. They kind of read like the Bar Torah sort of thing. They'll make an argument. They'll bring a proof text from a classical source. So you have the feeling of that you could imagine a guy giving this like a Shabbos Mincha thing or even Shabbat morning. It feels like a religious talk. Stylistically, and some of the content is religious also, very much around some of these core classical Jewish theological notions, like Geula, redemption. Yeah, Pam?
But at this time, I think even though what they were saying was based in Torah, they were also saying, those can't wait around for the Messiah, it's time to do something.
Okay, great. So that, of course, is the great question, because you've now introduced elements of continuity and discontinuity. And that is, I think, one of the great questions, and I'm just trying to think about what Zionism is. Is this about continuity or discontinuity? And what's the answer?
Both.
Or the clever was yes, right? It's really about both. And then you get into issues of, okay, but what exactly are we saying when we're saying that? But clearly, what we were reading last week suggests that they don't necessarily even want to be sort of dilating that vigorously on this question of, oh, are we self-styled, self-understood radicals, right? They're rabbis. They're clearly not radical in some very overt kind of way. So there's some degree of they're avoiding thinking through some of the more radical implications along the lines of what Pam just mentioned about sort of breaking with messianic doctrine. But it also you know clues us to the very real possibility that Zionism from the beginning is this kind of very funky dialectic of aspects of it that are traditional, like going back to the land of Israel, like the Hebrew language, but also aspects of it that are quite radical. The notion of political activism, the notion of maybe taking a religious concept and secularizing it in a potentially quite a profound way. And that's something that we'll see over and over again. People who may be making, in fact, quite radical moves, and yet they may be doing it through the vehicle of a very traditional kind of Jewish genre. To give you a contemporary example, or close to contemporary example, Yehuda Amichai, the late great poet of sort of late 20th century, early 21st century Israel. Amichai writes poetry, one of them is entitled El Malei Rachamim. Okay, El Malei Rachamim is what? What's the El Malei? Okay, it's a kind of a memorial prayer. So you think, hey, you know, right away, you think that's like a shul thing. It's like, you know, whatever. And yet, when you actually work through that poem, there's a kind of a deep rebelliousness to it, a deep reworking of some of these theological things. On the other hand, the thing is entitled El Malei Rachamim. So clearly, there's a kind of a very strong dialectical piece to that. And I think that's one of the things that makes Zionism so interesting, is that it's easy to break away radically from something and just say, well, you know what, I'm totally disconnected from what came before me and I want to create something totally new. What's usually much more interesting is when people preserve some sort of sense of dynamic tension with what came before them, and then that begs the question of just, okay, what exactly is that
attention really about. So it's great that you're picking up on that, because I do think that's one key piece of it. How effective are these guys? Like, at what level are they being productive? Not really, right? In other words, there's very little evidence that, oh yes, from them, hundreds or thousands of people feel like, yes, I've got to take up these ideas of messianic redemption and changing that. So they're not movement people, and that's why we kind of put them as 1.0 or whatever the right, you know, are they're a beta, you know, whatever that the correct terminology is for that. But clearly they are pre-something. Whether or not the pre-thing is the right way of categorizing it, that's a different issue. But clearly they're not really building a movement. They're beginning a conversation on some level that may or may not have had, you know, repercussions in terms of other people reading them and then thinking, gee, I'd like to improve upon this. They said they did this well, they didn't do that so well. But the point is, they're clearly not themselves really building anything. I missed somebody here. Maura, did I miss you?
Not me.
Who had their hand up that I missed?
I did.
Nancy, I'm sorry.
Yeah?
All right, so they get a check, it seems to me, for the sort of continuity discontinuity thing. They get a kind of a minus for movement. They're not really builders. They're thinkers. Anything else we want to say about it? Yeah.
Last week it sort of struck me that these guys were living in an era where nations were born by violence.
Yeah.
And they're talking about a nation being born in a different manner. And I just wondered whether they think there's something, quote unquote, holy about what's going to happen for a Jewish nation as opposed to all the nations that have been born in Europe.
That is a great insight, right? In other words, nationalism isn't invariably violent, but there are certain aspects of it that are that in the case of Germany, most famously, at least the tool for unifying Germany was the Franco-Prussian War. And in what other ways are nationalisms, you know, maybe not inherently violent, but significantly violent?
They sort of try to bring a uniformity to the people there. You're either in or you're out, and that often is down in a police state.
Well, or maybe not a police state, but certainly there is some notion of the privileging of the group over and against individual rights, right? They're more comfortable with some sort of authoritarian, culture, way of thinking about things. I mean, they're very, very much into the group. Typically, we talked about the fact that nationalism is oftentimes really ends up being much more about the tribe and about cultural stuff, historical stuff, potentially pseudoscientific racial stuff. So there is potentially, I think, a great propensity for not really being able to handle the other, not being able to handle diversity. And that, I think, is definitely an occupational hazard of this thing, number one. Number two, nationalism is not necessarily a kind of a seedbed for imperialism. But it is true that I think that just like nationalisms internally don't necessarily do that well with heterogeneity, the whole question of how they get along with each other in terms of international life is also, I think, an open question as well, in terms of this notion of, you know, there's something very ironic about self-determination. Do you take self-determination seriously only for yourself or for other people as well? So I think that will be an issue in modern political life too. And I think Ken's most important point of all is the extent to which the early Jewish nationalists see themselves as doing something fundamentally different. In other words, on the one end, clearly they are living in all of these periods of Europe where they're experiencing nationalistic activity. The Balkans, in the case of Alkali, Germany, Poland, in the case, you know, Middle Europe, in the case of Kalish Europe. So they are super aware of nationalism and nationalistic activity. And there's no doubt that that's a backdrop for them. On the other hand, they may have a sense
as you said, of a kind of an adaptation and an adoption of certain aspects of self-determination that sound very modern, but wedded to traditional ideas, including this idea that, yes, we are not going to be militaristic. Like, the Goyim will build nation states that are more violent, more jingoistic, potentially, but we're not going to do that. And the person that I'm writing a book about, Solomon Schefter, he talks a tremendous amount about this. That said, you know, that he's reluctant at a certain point in his career to become a Zionist precisely because he's afraid it's going to devolve, degenerate into just another European violent, aggressive nationalism. And the most famous figure, we'll get to it in a couple of weeks, who talks a lot about this is Ahada Am, the great cultural Zionist. Ahada Am also says, in this kind of counter-Nietzschean move, he says, oh, you know, the European mentality about Zionism is very, about nationalism, is very much about the will to power, like the will of the people to power, the will to self-government, the will to self-determination and the like. And there's a kind of a violent, you know, cast to that, and you know, Nietzsche talks about that in terms of overthrowing these sort of bourgeois notions of things like conscience and the like and morality. This is the whole Ubermensch thing. And Ahada Am will stand that on its head and say, no, the Jewish national greatness is not about power. It's about morality going all the way back to the prophets. And he says, and therefore, Jewish national life has got to be based upon this biblical, ethical worldview as opposed to just like, you know, how many divisions do you have kind of thing, like how many guns do you have. So I think, Ken, it's a great insight that really is another way of asking, I think, a much more profound question about Jewish nationalism, which is to what extent what's Jewish about it? Is it just nationalism for Jews, which is option one, right? Everybody else in the state, we got to have one too, which makes no claim to Jewish specialness. Option number two is, no, there's got to be something Jewy about it. And then once you get to that place, then the obvious question is, okay, and what is that Jewy piece? What's the Jewish ingredient? You know, what's the secret sauce kind of thing? And that's a huge argument that arguably you could argue goes on to today. You will see this, it's something to think about when you read Herzl's weird novel. What's Jewish about his vision of this thing he calls the new society? Is it just basically European, technocratic, bourgeois society for Jews in Palestine? Or is there something distinctively Jewy about it? And that really, I think it seems to me, is the larger question behind your question.
It also leads to the question, did the Jewish nation need to be in Israel?
Yes, absolutely, for sure. That for sure is the case on a strategic and a tactical level as well as on a philosophical level. You know, how important is Eretz Israel? But I want you to think some more about this question of the extent to which are these people saying, we want to have a state because everybody else wants to have one too, and we need to have one for the same reason, which is self-determination, or is there something else going on from a kind of a Jewish philosophical, spiritual, cultural perspective? That's a huge question that runs throughout the history of Zionist thought and life today. And again, if you think about Israel as you know it, my guess is that you have some sense of it. That is an ongoing tension in Israeli life today, which is, oh, how Jewy are we? How much do we even care about that question? Etc. Wendy, did I miss you? Okay. Good. So So he also sort of is the beginning of one piece of an answer to this question. And again, it's not like they settle this. I mean, there's no College of Cardinals here for this thing. I mean, they don't settle. This isn't the question that gets settled and then they move on to, okay, what's the next order of business kind of thing. This is an ongoing question in Zionism, which is, what's Jewish about it? And in what ways does that really matter? So fabulous insight, Ken. Other comments about Alkali Kalischer? Yeah, Wendy.
Isn't the question, with Jewish diet different for a lot of different factions and people, both back then with the first Aliyah and even today?
Yeah. What are you saying? Jews disagree internally? What are you saying? Absolutely. No, you ask a different person, you get a different answer to that, for sure. Again, you'll see it in the novel. Herzl basically couldn't care less about this question. Like, he's totally disinterested in this question of, oh, we got to have Hebrew, we got to have sisters, we got to have dolls and tefillin, we have to have, we have to have somebody to read the Torah on Monday and Thursday morning. He's totally outside of the sacred circle on all that kind of stuff. His concerns are much more materialist. Anti-Semitism is a problem, and we got to have a state to deal with that problem. That doesn't sound very Jewy to me. That sounds like Jews have a social problem, and Zionism is the solution to that social problem. It has nothing to do with stuff like, I hate my father / God, right? I hate the rabbis, I hate Halakha. Those are Jewy problems, and you've got Zionists who are kind of inventing off of those kinds of Jewish problems, and then you have other people who say, no, that's like a first world problem. Third, the real problem in life is people come to hit you over the head and you can't defend yourself. So absolutely, it's an argument then, it's an argument now. Alright, what about Hess? Any other questions, any comments on these guys before we just talk about Hess? Yeah, Mark.
Well, so Hess said that we should buy the land back from the Turks. So he was in Israel. So he wasn't envisioning a violent takeover of Israel.
Right.
To transition. So that was his answer.
Okay.
And he thought that the French and others would just automatically think that was a great idea and somehow contribute to the cause.
Yeah, why? Why does he think that?
That I don't understand.
What? Well, I'm sorry. Yeah, number one, it's getting rid of their own Jewish problem. What other default assumption does he have? The whole French v. Turkish thing? Where the Jews fit in? There's like kind of a triangulation thing he's playing off there. What do you think it is? I found it. Welcome back. No more playing with, grandchildren or other people. We have far too many family attachments for distracting people. It's a serious study. So what's the whole Jewish, Turkish, French thing? What's going on? What game is he playing there? Why does he think the French will align with the Jews vis-a-vis the Turk? Yeah, Joan? Okay, interesting.
Well,
I'm so happy for you. That's the next time you go to a good French bakery, you'll have more enthusiasm for supporting the cause. I think that the business, yeah, Nancy, you want to throw it in?
Universalism on one hand, and just a quick question, is the ethical secular socialism he talks about in the book Culture?
No.
Or is it different?
Different.
That was just an aside.
Yeah, no, that's a good question.
Because is it stolen, this universalism, but then he moves into, basically the Germans hate us, and,
right.
There are all these sort of self-hating Jews. And
good.
But he's still
extolling
this whole, harmonious.
Right.
Great.
Yeah,
I had trouble. I couldn't figure out.
Look, these guys had trouble with himself, so there's no reason why you shouldn't have trouble with them also. All right, so let's unpack him a little bit. Who is this guy, Moshe Hess? Okay, so he comes from a religious family. He's got some religious baggage in a good way. Professional meaning, like an attorney, is that what? Yeah.
He came down.
Okay, so number one, he's got some Jewish background. That's piece number one of his bio. He's not a secular Jew in the sense of it's not that he knows nothing about traditional Jewish life. He does. Okay, so that's kind of piece number one of him. Piece number two that's crucial is what?
Didn't he reject on that for like 20 years?
Why? What's that? What's the rejection piece about? Yeah, Wendy?
Isn't he like a socialist?
Yeah.
So he thought that man had sinned, it's terrible, and he married a prostitute to make up for all of man's sins, and so he was a little off the beaten track.
Yeah, okay. Let's talk about, before we talk about the prostitute piece, that's a nice brewery in detail, but what's the socialism about? What's going on there? I mean, Americans are traditionally a little bit tone deaf when it comes to socialism. You know, we have a tradition of socialism in this country, but it hasn't clearly been super successful politically. And you know, we want to call people to anytime we anybody to the left of us, we brand them a socialist because it's like the Antichrist kind of thing. So there's not a whole lot of intellectual dexterity in this country around talking about socialism, which I think makes us a little bit tone deaf to the power of it as a kind of a phenomenon in a lot of places in the world as a political and social phenomenon. So that's quite unfortunate in terms of our inability to really grapple with it in a serious way. What are we talking about when we're talking about socialism? Yeah.
Well, he was a contemporary and like a friend is probably not the right word, but he was with Marx.
Okay.
And their stuff and they knew each other.
Yeah.
And so they talked ideology together.
Okay, so let's talk about Marx for a second. He is a buddy of Marx. He's a colleague of Marx. They fall out. Marx sort of dismisses him and says, oh, you know, Hess, smart guy, but he was kind of soft. He says, oh, he wasn't really a scientific socialist. He was really an ethical socialist. This is a kind of a, may sound seem a somewhat obscure distinction, but it's worth pausing over that for 1 second. What's the difference between a scientific socialist and an ethical socialist? Right? Marx, you can visit Marx's desk at the British Library, which is now, you know, sort of sits inside the British Museum, not the British Museum, they moved it somewhere else. You know, Marx writes Kapital. He thinks of himself as a scientific socialist. What does that mean? Yeah?
Pat said, I think it's more communism without any softness to it.
Okay, but what's the science piece, Joe?
The science piece is you take everything as a priori, and you know, you get a little bit equal distribution. Thank you. You know, everybody gets the same piece. And I think the ethical part comes in when you see that you have to sort of meld the system better. You have to meld the system because
okay.
The pure scientific, the pure member.
What did science get you to? Yeah?
I assume he was talking about maximizing social welfare, or is the ethical socialist think this is the right thing to do?
Well, that's definitely true. Like, in other words, the ethical socialist thinks, I'm a socialist because it is a more moral system for maybe creating wealth or distributing wealth or, you know, whatever it is you're claiming, owning the means of production, it's more just, right? There's a kind of an ethical theory behind it, or an ethical impulse at the very least. Yeah, Nancy?
The way I read it, Marx seemed to want more of a standardized across cultures socialism, whereas Hess was talking about a harmonious symphony
okay.
of national...
Right, very like Moosewood Cookbook kind of,
right.
Yeah. Yeah, good. Okay. Yeah.
Like each culture will react to
yeah, a bunch of horse shit. Yeah,
like,
right.
We're
going to
be scientific.
And okay, so now let's talk about science. What does science add to this? What do scientists do? What do they do?
Find the answer.
They prove what?
They come up with that hypothesis. They test it.
Like, I know, but what are they actually doing? Like, what are they discovering? What are they
underlying truths?
Truths that exist where?
In the physical world,
in nature. Right? They're finding out, like, the special theory of relativity. Einstein, he says, look, I'm not making this stuff up. I'm figuring out the way the world works. I'm unlocking the secrets of the machine, kind of thing. So for Marx to call himself a scientific socialist, what is he kind of philosophically claiming about the nature of the world that we live in as human beings?
That there's one truth?
No. There are laws of economics. Right? We think economics are things like, to take examples from American history, economics are a function of the fact that white WASP bankers didn't like Jews and wouldn't lend them money. Or, white bankers in the South wouldn't lend money to blacks, or white, the guys who controlled the congressional committees made sure that things like Social Security didn't go to poor black tenant farmers. Like, we think, hey, that's not about laws of nature, that's about a bunch of bigoted people who have positions of power who screwed other people they didn't like. Marx says, yeah, on the kind of like the phenomenal level, for sure all that stuff happens, that's kind of politics, but he's living in a time, he's a student of a guy named Hegel, who talks about laws of historical change. He thinks what he's really doing is uncovering the laws of the way economics really works on a much deeper level.
For achieving what aim?
For achieving... Well, first of all, he's not, if necessarily, even going to the normative place that Bruce is taking us to. He is saying that human society evolved according to certain laws. And that's going to happen. It's going to happen regardless of whether or not you like it. It's going to, meaning that we went from feudalism to capitalism, and capitalism will ultimately give way to some version of post-capitalist society. He thinks that's sort of built into human economic development. What does the economist do? He understands that process. So, of course, there's a Cam mentioned messianism a few minutes ago. There's something incredibly exciting about that, because at some level you feel like, you know what, this guy is not throwing darts at the board. He's basically saying, this is happening. This is going to happen. And I think part of the energy of socialism that is so exciting for people is to feel like this is way beyond, guys who own factories are selfish bastards who exploit people who, sweat over sewing machines for 20 cents a piece. Right? If you look at it on that level, you say, well, you know what? The bastards might win. Like, we might have this crappy system of exploitation for a million years. Socialism comes along and says, you know what? It won't last. And there's a kind of a confidence in this notion of economic change that I think is very contagious. I mean, it sounds a lot like a religion in that way. Yeah.
It's a belief in an invisible hand.
Yeah.
Right.
So mixed metaphor.
Yeah. Right. Adam Smith is very much not, that right. There are laws, and you're trying to sort of figure out what those things actually look like, how they operate, and the like. So that's Marx.
Which, by the way, sounds much more like a political theory than economic theory.
Okay. So, I think that this, of course, grows up alongside
physics. That's more like physics and Brownian motion and some of those, if you believe that that's how things are interacted.
I think it's more in the realm of political than economic.
Well, it turned out that that's what it was, but the belief might be that those are actual.
Yeah, and I think that part, I mean, look, obviously this is growing up with the Industrial Revolution, And it does become politicized in terms of discrete pieces of legislation that are sort of playing around the edges of this. But, I mean, I think that Marx is a great challenge to sort of the conventional liberal way of thinking about creation of wealth and the like, because he says, look, you know what, this is going not to last. The world that we live in of capital and people having freedom to do stuff, at some level he's saying there's something kind of illusory about that. It's, you know, ultimately there are much deeper structures that, and those things will kind of win out. Now, of course, from the standpoint, why would Jews join up with this worldview?
They had nothing. We were proletarians.
Well, they weren't, but they weren't necessarily proletarians. That later on, many more Jews are proletarianized, right? They're moving from the shtetl into larger cities like Lodz, Warsaw, and the like. England, places like Manchester, right, where you have these huge, you know, textile factories. So Jews do become proletarianized over time, but at this point in time, they're mainly not. Like, they typically are small merchants, petty bourgeois types. Why would they be attracted to socialism? Yeah, Wendy?
Because they don't belong. They're the other. And so if they join a new movement, everything's
okay.
Going to be
new. Right. Fabulous. In other words, the appeal of this socially, and not just as a kind of like a fairly ethereal, you know, economic theory, the appeal of it politically and potentially, you know, ethically, is it has an explanation for why prejudice occurs, which is what? No, but you skipped a step. Why is there prejudice? Why is it that blacks are treated so badly according to this, to a kind of a Marxian theory? Right? What's this? There's a famous phrase that is associated with this. The poor white should really think in class terms about his allegiance with whom? Right, he should rethink that. He should realize, you know what, the guy, the planter, the guy who owns the textile factory in North Carolina, he is my enemy. He's screwing me every single day. Right, he's the one who owns my sewing machine. He's the one who demands I produce so many pieces a day. He's the one who's going to keep me in this company town, right? Substandard housing, health, it's education, blah, blah, blah. How is the nigger my enemy? Right? So why does this guy not revolt against that system in a place like the South? Why doesn't he revolt?
He has nowhere else to go.
Sure he does. He could potentially join forces on class lines with blacks. This did happen in the post-Civil War South. It didn't succeed, but it happened. That was populism, or some version of populism, right? How come the poor white is so stupid that he doesn't see that the guy who's killing him is not the black, the poor black, but the guy who owns his sewing machine? How come he doesn't see that?
Because he wants to feel that he's better than
that's him. Right. And that, of course, is Marxian notion of false consciousness that says, part of why it's so difficult politically and morally to uproot this is because people have other irrational attachments like tribe, religion, race, that gets in the way of people realizing that their real enemy is the guy who owns their sewing machine.
Sounds like the modern Republican
Party. Don't get me started. Okay? This is a huge argument in American political history about the extent to which people, you know, Richard Hofstadter wrote a great famous book about this, The American Political Tradition, that says, look, we want to think, a la Jefferson, we're all middle class, we're all together, when in fact, we're not all together. Some of us own the sewing machines and some of us don't. Some of us can afford to send our kids to college, and some of us are never going to be able to buy, to have the resources to buy these scarce goods and services. Americans don't like to think in those terms. I mean, that's a part of the what's interesting about American political culture. So now let's circle back to the Jews. Why would socialism be so, what would potentially be such an appealing alternative way of thinking about reality for Jews? Because what does it say about all of these other kinds of ideologies, ethnicity, religion, and the like? What does it say about them? It doesn't matter. They're not important. They're not real. They're distractions. So there's something incredibly exciting about this, because Jews feel like socialism is universalism in the most profound sense, that all these other things that people build are really distraction from what should tie us together, which is the laws of economics. And that doesn't mean that all Jews become socialists, but what it does mean is that I think it is very appealing to certain kinds of intellectual Jewish men and women who think of it as a system for eradicating the base of anti-Semitism. Because I talked about the white-black example. In Europe, a lot of people focus on the Jewish-Gentile example. Feel like, you know what, Jews are being persecuted because of ethnicity, tribe, religion stuff. Socialism will sweep all that away. Now, of course, that ultimately that doesn't happen. But people believe that. Yeah, Nancy.
In its early stages, I would guess that socialism also would likely be part of an international intellectual movement.
Exactly.
That didn't require conversion.
Right.
And didn't require that you reject your that didn't require that you leave, or at least in these early days, that you leave your tradition behind and did not necessarily run counter to anything in Jewish teaching.
Well, at least on a theoretical level, although I think part of what happens for Jews is they realize that, number one, most people end up being much more doctrinaire, in fact, do think that all this stuff is garbage, and they want to universalize and sort of deracinate themselves, right, to kind of take out all the particularistic pieces, number one. Number two, in some ways even perhaps more intuitively, this happens most famously in places like Russia. They discover that, you know what, when you really get down to cases, the Russian socialists, they still don't like the Jews. And that's where the Bund comes from. The Bund is basically a counter-socialist formation of Jewish socialists in Tsarist Russia who wanted to be a part of Russian socialism kind of regularly. And guess what? The Russians still thought of them as Jews, and they didn't want them. So they formed their own socialist organization. That's the Bund. So yes, in theory, the power of it was this very kind of post-ideological, post-ethnic, post-tribal equality world. In practice, and of course you see this in places like China today. You know, nationalism, you could argue from a completely radical perspective, socialism should have swept away nationalism. It didn't do that. Look at China. China's like a weird example of socialism now, too. So it's like a bad example in all kinds of ways. But even when China was much more doctrinaire, like pre-Deng Xiaoping, when it was much more doctrinaire about socialism, and it wasn't like Chinese nationalism, just like they snapped their fingers and it went away. So nationalism turns out to be super sticky, and I think that's part of Hess's pushback against it, right? Hess starts off, so now let's just jump back to Hess, starts off, he likes the universalistic kind of edginess of socialism, falls in with posts like Marx. Then what? So then why is he in this book if he just became one more Jewish socialist? Yeah?
I think he got disillusioned.
How come?
Because he figured out that even though he and maybe a lot of others tried to be like everyone else in society, that society was never going to let us forget.
Well, that's one thing. But even inside of socialism, what is Marx, from the Jewish standpoint, what is Marx? Marx is a lover of the Jews?
No.
What's he famous for when he talks about the Jews? Yeah?
Doesn't like Jews.
How come? What doesn't Marx like about the Jews? And by the way, he came from a baptized family. It wasn't like he had his own Jewish baggage, which is, you know, obviously complicated by definition. But what did he say about the Jews? There was such a kind of mischievous, pernicious sort of thing that really, talk about sticky, that really ended up sticking to the Jews. What did he say about the Jews?
Nothing good.
What? No, that's too simple. What did he say? Anybody know? When Marx talks about sort of, you know, capitalism and bourgeois values, who does he sort of tar with it? The Jews. He says the Jews are sort of the avatars for all these values that we don't like. They are sort of like bourgeois, you know, bourgeoisness, you know, personified. And so this will become a part of the kind of infamous, this sense that a lot of European Jews have. This will certainly resonate for Zionists, that, you know, capitalists see Jews as socialists, and socialists see Jews as capitalists. Right? So Marx is a part of that kind of phenomenon, and I think that Hess sort of pushes back against it. Like, he sees, yes, okay, I'm still very into universalism. I don't disbelieve in socialism, but meanwhile, I see that socialism is clearly, in and of itself, not enough to solve the Jewish problem. The Jewish problem is the fact that people don't like Jews. And part of the reason why they don't like Jews is because, in fact, ethnicity is sticky. And the question is it sticky only in the bad sense, that people are just like hopelessly parochial, and they just like doing the sharks and jets thing all the time, and they just can't get along? Or is it sticky maybe in some kind of a good way, that there actually is some kind of actual legitimate basis for ethnicity? Well, so where does he come out on that? Is there anything of redeeming value about Jewishness? Or is it like, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre, who basically said, you know, the anti-Semite produces the Jew kind of thing? What does he say about that? Does he kind of rediscover his Jewishness in a more bullish way? Yeah?
Well, I thought when I was reading a little bit about the fact that they didn't have much in there, but it reminds me he was like a pre-Gwen person. Because I remember that the Gwen movement in Poland was when first year camps for kids, and, you know, they did a lot of really humanistic socialist sense.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to push the Jewishness, but they realized that you've got to push the Jewishness and you have to push the socialism.
Absolutely.
So that's what I think he's doing. And that's what I
learned. Right. So
ethical socialism.
Good.
That's what I thought he was.
So I think, anybody want to follow up on what Joan just said? I mean, is he kind of finding his way back to a positive valuation of Jewishness, whatever that means to him? Or is this just like a kind of a defense against the anti-Semitism of the left? I mean, what's he saying here? He writes his book, Rome and Jerusalem. Yeah, Nancy?
Well, he says that Judaism is both national and universal.
Okay.
So that he feels that the Jews do have something, the light onto the nation thing.
Great.
He doesn't speak of any other people as both national and universal.
Yeah. So that's fabulous. So the point is, he is saying, and by the way, what's the whole thing about, there's a kind of a subtle sort of byplay here, the notion of Jews as a nation. Who's he arguing with there? Pam?
Well, I think one of the things, doesn't he look at the reformers?
Yes.
You're like barking up the wrong tree.
Yes.
You can't keep trying to assimilate the
Jews. Fabulous. Great that you saw that.
Nationalism is the only...
Good. So what's wrong with reform in terms of this whole are Jews a nation or not conversation? They want to be, well, like, just like eat shrimp cocktail at the holiday party? What are we talking about here? There's that piece. No, there is that behavioral piece, which is they want to drop the customs, like all the weird, you know, we have three heads and horns set of customs. So So they're very self-conscious about that kind of stuff. But there's a larger, you know, we talked a little about this with Mendelssohn, that the reform philosophy is based upon what view of, you know, what is Jewishness intrinsically? Is it a religion or is it a nation? Remember, we talked about this whole notion of, is Judaism a politics or not? What does reform say? It's a religion. Good. It's a religion and not a politics. See, what you're getting now is the sort of pushback and then the counter pushback. The reformers had said, a la Mendelssohn, Judaism is not a politics, it's a religion. It's like Protestantism. Okay? They had also said, along the lines of Hegelian notions of historical development, it's okay not to keep kosher, because the point is, we kept kosher at a certain moment in our history, and that was totally fine. That moment has now changed, right? And now we have a different theory and approach to stuff like halakha. So they're not walking, you know, the serious Reform Jew is not walking around feeling like, you know what, I am so embarrassed that I eat shrimp cocktail. The serious Reform Jew ought to say, I'm not embarrassed at all, because I don't philosophically believe that Judaism is about what Isaac Mayer Wise once cleverly called pots and pantheism. Right? Judaism is a kind of an approach to history that says, you know what? There's evolution in culture. Just like evolution in all kinds of other things. Why am I embarrassed about not wanting to do something that people did 500 years ago? Like, why should I be doing the same thing by definition? So the point is, their sense of movement around moving off of politics, number one, moving off of traditional Jewy stuff, number two, their attitude is, this is totally apropos for being a modern, sophisticated, historically minded 19th century person. Hess's pushback to that is what? Yeah, and then I'll get you, Wendy.
Oh, no, he says there's an essential national character of the Jewish religion.
Okay.
And that unbelief in our nationality as the foundation of Judaism is just wrong.
Okay, so, great. So this is a classic philosophical argument. Is life about being or becoming? Right? Is there such a thing as the essence of a thing? Or is a thing only sort of like, you know, organic? Right? What you just said, Hess comes down on which side of this line? Is Judaism about being / having an essence, like core things? To use, who's that guy, Good to Great guy? Collins? Right? Organizations have core principles, core values, and then they innovate around everything else. Like, is that the way religious bodies ought to be also? Drill into, you know, what is my essence? What are my core values? My timeless principles, immutable thing? And then you innovate around everything else? Or is everything organic? Hess is saying what? What Nancy just said. Are there timeless, essential things? That's the national piece. So that's the point is, that's a real argument. Like, that's a profound argument about how you think reality. People like Plato and Aristotle argued about this. Right? Plato had this idea, these sort of pure ideas that sort of exist outside of, you know, sort of time and space, as it were. Right? Aristotle, in some ways a much more pragmatic figure, says, you know, it's much more about becoming. You make your soul by virtue of what you do. You sort of grow into yourself. There's a kind of constant process of bashing. So, you know, people have been talking about this for a really, really long time. Most of us really want to believe that there are essential things. Why do you think that is, just sort of psychologically? Yeah, you want to kind of know who you are. I think the whole need to feel like, yes, I got core principles, and then I sort of invent off of everything else, innovate around everything else. People like to feel like there's some sense of stability around, yes, this is who I am. I'm a national, I'm a this, I'm a that. So I think that's sort of the Platonic voice in us that is really drawn to that, even though, and of course, because this whole piece is incredibly stressful. It means you're inventing, you're reinventing, stuff is changing all the time. You don't really know who you are. Who you are is a function of what you did yesterday, kind of thing. And there's something very, by definition, fluid about that. So the reformers, in some ways, are saying that the essence of Judaism is ethics, and all of the practice stuff is organic, which is hence the shrimp cocktail. Like, who hears about the shrimp cocktail in 1850? We're not living in 300, right? So the ethics of the prophets are the unchangeable thing. What do the orthos say? What's the essence for the orthos?
Practice.
The practice, right? The law. Right? So that's this is another way of sort of understanding the post-Mendelssohnian argument. Wendy, you were very patient. I'm sorry to make you wait.
So it seemed this way, but these reformers are like the American reformers?
No, these are his German compatriots.
But it sounds like it's Luther. Very similar.
No, yes, although, right. Luther, in his own way, yes, he was sort of seen as like a kind of a German godfather of this, in a way, absolutely, yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead, Wendy.
It seems very similar, though, to the beliefs of the American Reform Movement.
Are you asking a question about German Reform vis-a-vis American Reform?
About the reformers. Is that what kind of started the American Reform Movement?
Well, that's an argument that the late Leon Jick, I mean, that's an argument about the how is it that Reform, in effect, transplanted itself from places like Germany to America. One school of thought said it was basically a pretty direct idea transference kind of deal, and it was really about rabbis and sort of these sorts of philosophical arguments. The other argument, which was put forth by the late Leon Jick, who taught at Brandeis for many, many years, Leon argued that, in fact, American Reform came from a very different place, that the people who came to this country, these sort of mid-19th century peddler types, were traditional Jews, and they stopped being traditional not because of some set of, you know, very interesting but somewhat abstruse intellectual argument. They stopped being traditional because they couldn't keep Shabbos in, you know, St. Joseph, Missouri kind of thing. It had nothing to do with a set of intellectual problems. They came wanting to be Jewish, but their Jewishness just changed because of the texture of life in a place like America. So that, you know, that's a good kind of historical argument. I think Leon is largely right about that. But Hess was dealing with, I think, a reality that he saw all around him, which was, number one, Jews were adopting liberal myth in religion. And number two, in some ways, ironically or not, it was rendering them in some ways even more vulnerable to anti-Semitism. Because traditionally, Jews had suffered because it was like the three heads and horn things. Like, they were so weird, they had these different practices. And they sort of thought somewhat, you know, sort of optimistically, well, you know, once we stop doing that, then we'll fit in. And in fact, in places like Germany, which were in some ways pretty conservative, figures like Bismarck said, I wouldn't trust a liberal Jew. A guy who's not even loyal to his own people, how am I going to think he's going to be loyal to the right? Like, I'm much more comfortable with the orthos. Like, they are sort of loyal to their own community. So, and of course, that was also a cultural bias as well, because he wasn't a liberal person. But, you know, the point is, Hess is sort of seeing these guys and feeling like, you know what, they can't defend Jewish life against anti-Semitism because they refuse to acknowledge the true basis of what Judaism even is, which is a nationality. And so he felt like they are in many ways the problem, or they are kind of an exacerbation of the problem. And that's what's kind of driving, that's the backstory to Rome and Jerusalem, which is trying to make the argument that says you don't need to feel, because of course the classical thing was always, well, if you're too national, it must mean that you are anti-universal. Right? That was the reform argument. The reform polemic was, if you're so into these atavistic tribal loyalty things, you'll be anti-universal, and that's both philosophically, you know, bad, and also politically problematic. Hess stands that on its head by saying, in effect, no, Judaism, the beauty of Judaism is that it's always been about these two things. It's always been about universal values, that's the whole prophetic thing, but it's always been encased in a national frame. The national frame is what sort of preserves its integrity. And then his argument is, and look at the reformers. They did away with the national frame, and what are they? They're kind of lost. They're sort of, you know, and they're defenseless. Peter, you were very patient. I apologize for making you wait.
I read Hess, maybe I'm incorrect, that it was, dispersion was inevitable of Jews. And I read that as kind of being on the left side of your being. And that Israel, the state of Israel, was on the right side in terms of the national. And I didn't sense that he had an either or. He just kind of said, this is the world we live in.
Yeah.
And there's a role for a man, a nation.
Yeah.
But we also are realistic in understanding that Jews are going to disperse themselves.
Right.
And I didn't get a sense that you have to become part of a nation.
Right. Well, or at least in practical terms.
Yes.
Right. Did other people share that? In other words, is he saying kind of Zion or bust? Because that's what Peter is sort of pushing on. Is he a... What's your sense? Pam and then Mort?
Well, I don't think he said everybody had to move to, you know, for the promised land. But I think he said that without it, the only other option is for the Jews to be in the diaspora and always try to get emancipated, and you were never really going to get emancipated completely.
Right.
So
good.
You had to have that, even if you weren't there, as long as that was there and there was a Jewish nation, then you had sort of a leg to stand on.
Yeah.
If you were in the diaspora.
You know, we'll talk. Fabulous. You guys were a great team, buddy. You should be. I think that's exactly. Look, the whole emancipation. We'll talk a lot more about this when we get to Herzl. What you're beginning to sort of pick up on here in terms of the texture of the conversation is a real pushback against this whole emancipationist ideology that says if only we do this and this and this, they will accept us. Right? And what you're beginning to hear is people saying with some degree of, you know, cynicism, agnosticism, whatever, you know what? I'm not so sure. There is something fundamentally askew here, and I don't think it's about how much tripe I eat at the holiday party. Like, it's not clear to me that there's anything. There's something structurally built into this emancipationist worldview that is problematic. Everything from the denationalization of the identity to maybe, you know, sort of unmooring oneself from one's tradition. He is not like a Valchuva. He's not like saying, oh yes, I'm going to re-orthodox myself. That's not what he's saying at all. Although he is, I think, aware of the fact that part of being a nation is, yes, you do have national customs, whatever that means. You know, sort of, you know, TBD kind of thing. But still in all, like, that's a good conversation to have. And by the way, inside of Reform, and I'll get you to, inside of Reform, the same conversation goes on. I mean, your neighbor, Jonathan Sarna, has written a lot about this. In other words, there are moments in Reform life where they are super universalistic and assimilationistic and anti-ritual. And then guess what? They crawl back to the cave a little bit. Right? Isaac Mayer Weiss's daughter intermarries. There's anti-Semitism after the Civil War. They say, hey, you know what? Let's re-embrace ritual. Let's re-embrace some boundaries. Those of you who are members of Reform, how many Reform Jews have I insulted tonight, by the way? Okay, not enough, clearly. That would be sick. Okay. All right, so you swim both ways. No, but the point is, those of you who are plugged into Reform life, even in the last, you know, 10, 20 years, you see this.
Reform has a very rich kind of pendulum, or whatever you want to call it, around peoplehood, around ritual. You know, I mean, I served with a guy in Great Neck who, you know, who wore a yarmulke, and when he told, the rabbi, who was much more liberal than he was, you know, rabbi, oh, I plan to wear a yarmulke on the bima. The rabbi said, well, that's totally fine, Isaac, but I need you to go see so-and-so, you know, one of the board members. And so he goes to see this person, and the guy just looks at him and says, well, that's Rabbi Barzilai, thank you very much for telling me that, but I just want you to know that if you do that, I'm resigning from the congregation. So the point is, there's a kind of a generational back and forth thing to this argument. So that's part of what you're hearing here, is him, is a kind of, in some ways, you could argue, kind of an organic pushback around this denationalization, liberalization, and the like. I missed somebody here. Jen.
I just keep coming back to the whole idea of this gets tried and this gets tried, but the bottom line is they're never going to get accepted. And, you know, in Jerusalem now, there's this Herzl Museum, which essentially, I don't know if you've been there, it's this interactive movie. It's 1 hour, you go in and you see some of Herzl's things, and then they show, it's kind of a play in a play of how Herzl created the World Jewish Congress and why he felt so strongly about going to Israel. And the bottom line is he just truly believed that nobody was, you could either be being or becoming religious or not. The non-Jewish world was never going to accept us no matter what we did.
Well,
and that being in Israel was the only way.
Yeah, that's a huge part of it. Herzl, by the way, said, he was very appropriate about this, he said, if I had known about Hesse's pamphlet, Rome and Jerusalem, I never would have written the Jewish State. I never would have written the Jewish State, meaning he had a sense of that when he discovered Hesse later in his life, he felt like, oh, he anticipated most of my core themes. I mean, there are pieces of Herzl we'll talk about, you know, after Thanksgiving, that Hess did not see. But I think some of these core diagnostics, Hess was really on top of. Emancipation is problematic, denationalization is problematic, it makes it much harder for people kind of to have an instinct towards self-preservation. A lot of different pieces are very much there. Who did I miss here? Wanted to say something. I missed somebody. Is Hess an advance over the two rabbis, Alkaline Kalischer? How does he sort of push, how does he sort of move the needle?
He says we've got to take action to buy back the land from the Turks.
Yeah.
And establish a country.
Yeah.
So in that respect, he's not leaving it up to faith. He's saying, let's have a plan.
Right. And I, yeah, Wendy and then Nancy, time is now. And what about the anti-Semitism? He said those guys really kind of focused on anti-Semitism? Not so much. I think that's, to me, that's the big pair. I mean, yeah, the stuff with the National and Universal is super clever, and I think that's very well done. But I think his big move forward is to much more overtly take on emancipation. Yeah.
Much less like a Jabbar torrent.
Yes.
And much more of sort of like social commentary.
Yeah, I agree. Much less religious in the textual sense. It doesn't read the same way. Absolutely. Okay, any other comments about Hess? Did I miss anybody? Wanted to add anything? Okay. So Pinsker, how are we doing time-wise? 8:38. Pinsker. Pinsker's writing in the early 1880s. Hess is writing in the 1860s. Oh, by the way, the title Hess, Rome and Jerusalem. To what does that refer? We talking like town tours of the Mediterranean? What's that about? Yeah.
Yes, the Rome is the religious sort of center, the natural place for the Christian, at least for Catholicism.
You're such a good Catholic, Nancy. I love that about you. I know that people always guess that. It's actually any other guesses? I mean, yeah, that's a good intuitive guess. Not true, yeah, not correct, but a good guess.
Well,
yeah. Also a very good guess, also incorrect.
The emperor?
The empires of Ottoman Empire and the
No, Rome, 1862. The clue is the date. What has just happened relatively recently in Rome by 1862? Go ahead.
Unification.
Very good. The reunification of Italy. So again, this is a kind of a nationalist tract, T-R-A-C-T. And this goes back to some of the very insightful comments about teasing out, you know, how do I talk about nationalism in a positive way as a socialist and as a Jew? So he's looking at Rome, he's looking at Italian unification, and he's trying to figure out, what do I learn from that for Jews? And is there a teaching in that? Right? That, yeah, nationalism is a legitimate activity. Right? Jews should not, I mean, because after all, what had held back Italian unification until the 1850s? Right? What kept the Italian? What took them so long? Yeah. In other words, they didn't necessarily even believe in the notion of Italianness in the same overt kind of structural political way. So, in some ways, that's a kind of a paradigm shift for Hess. Hess is saying, you know, look, the Italians got it. They re-embraced a kind of a notion of Italianness. They created Italy, right? And then they went about, according to the adage that I mentioned a few weeks ago, first they created Italy, then they went about making Italians. But they understood that it was an important thing structurally, conceptually, to embrace the category of national identity. Once you have that, you can then fill in all the details. You can fill in the frame. But you have to agree on the idea of the frame as the nation. Once you have that, then you figure out, okay, so this will be stuff from the Piedmont. This will be stuff from Tuscany. This will be stuff, you know, from Sicily, whatever. But first, you've got to agree that Italy is a thing. You've got to make that a reality. And then you figure out, okay, we're going to eat with cream sauce, we're going to eat with tomato sauce, like what's that going to look like? So that's huge for him. And the question is, will Jerusalem become like Rome in that kind of a way? That's the prospective normative voice in him saying, let's re-embrace Jewish national identity. Once we commit to that, then it's a matter of figuring out, you know, how to make it happen. That's a kind of becomes a kind of a social political engineering problem. But first, you got to commit to the idea of the nation, which is why, and you'll see this in a lot of Zionist writing, the reformers are the bad guys. The reformers are the black hats. Because reform is the most compelling anti-national voice in modern Jewish life. It says it's about ethics, it's about integration, it's about being a light unto the nation. And the national stuff just gets in the way. Nationalism is reactionary. By the way, who else will call nationalism reactionary? Socialists.
Marx.
Yeah, exactly. So this will become a huge challenge for Zionists. They will be accused of being politically reactionary.
by people on the left and by religious liberals. They say, you want to take us back to the ghetto. Tel Aviv is just like a funkier version of the medieval ghetto. So that's a good argument. Like, that's a real argument in modern Jewish life. Okay. So, from 1862, fast forward to 1882-83. What has happened in the intervening 20 years that brings us to Pinsker? Yeah, Eric?
There are a number of bad pogroms in Russia, to the point where in 1881 there is one that's so bad that it's like the tipping point.
Okay.
Good.
So, very important, this whole notion, again, sort of action and reaction. What was the backstory to the pogroms? I mean, because you could argue, like, what's the argument against what Eric just said that says, oh, you know what, these pogroms sort of shocked people so dramatically that you had some kind of reaction formation around, well, clearly, whatever we've been doing in the past isn't working, we need to do something radically different. What's the argument, kind of the logical argument against that? Yeah? Dan and then Nancy?
We're always on something.
Yeah. Shit was always happening. So that's a good counter-argument, which is not that's not necessarily a refutation of what Eric said. But the question is, just saying pogroms, by definition, you're sort of assuming it has a causality that you don't necessarily know based upon Jews maybe feeling like, you know what, this is a part of what it means to live in a place like Eastern Europe, there's occasionally outbursts of Jewish violence. It doesn't explain the timing per se. You need more information in that, following that line of reasoning. Yeah, Dan?
No, we're having the advantage, so we thought things were changing.
Okay.
Yet it's still in fact.
Okay, great.
Changing.
Okay.
That's what was so shocking.
All right, so that is the kind of revolution of rising expectations approach to history. Meaning there was a sector of Russian Jews who thought Russia was changing along this kind of emancipationist line. And then what Eric said clicks in, namely Tsar Alexander II is assassinated. The reaction to that is pogroms in some fashion. The reaction to that is this kind of sense of, oh, our expectations were totally incorrect. And there's a kind of a shock, trauma piece to that. And then out of that emerges some kind of early Zionist thinking a la Pinsker. Yeah, Wendy?
Wasn't it also, I mean, the assassination of the Tsar, but wasn't it also that the participation by the Russian people was much more widespread than previously? So you were getting educated people, wealthy people, there was just a lot more different classes of people participating.
Yeah, that becomes a part of our popular narrative. It's not totally clear if that's really true, but for sure it definitely becomes a part of the collective memory story, kind of recounting of it. All right, Joan, and then I want to go back to unpack this emancipation thing for a second.
With the Industrial Revolution and the economics, maybe people moving over to farms, with the Russian people moving into Austria.
That's a little bit later, but let's unpack Russia for a second, okay? 1825 to 1855, Tsar Nicholas I, he's sort of like the bad Tsar. He's the one who, I know that sounds a little bit... He's the one who institutes the drafting of Jewish boys under the age of 18, anywhere from, say, 12 to 18. The standard term of service in the Russian army was 25 years, 18 to 43. The Jewish draft of these boys was anywhere from, again, like 12 to 18, whatever that means. The Jewish community had to basically decide. They were given a kind of a number of, you know, how many heads per 1,000 or 10,000, whatever, and they had to decide who would be drafted.
Of course, typically it meant not the children of rabbis, not the children of rich merchants, children of single mothers, poor people. So there was a class element to this in a very kind of ugly way. There was a kind of a cottage industry that spread, grew up around this, of bounty hunters, because of course people were desperate to try to sort of spirit their kids away. Yeshivas grew up in part in response to this, because you could get some version of almost a kind of an exemption if your kid was in yeshiva. So people desperately tried to send their kids away to these larger yeshivas, and they grow up around this. But there were these, what was called in Yiddish, these hoppers, who were basically bounty hunters, who would kidnap poor kids to try to meet the quota. So there's a lot of internal Jewish dissension around the draft stuff. But the other thing that Nicholas I does, for which he's much less well known, is he builds Russian-sponsored state schools for Jewish kids. Why does he do that? What's the goal there? Why would he build schools for them? Maybe to convert them, although they weren't, they were Jewish schools.
Contribute to society.
Yeah. Classic Enlightenment theory that says one of the reasons why Jews are so backwards and so socially deviant, right? A lot of anti-Jewish baggage in that. One of the reasons why Jews are so sociopathic is because we made them that way because we segregated them. If we change that, we build schools for them, we encourage them to learn Russian, to read Pushkin, become more Russified, you know what? They'll contribute more. That was kind of classic Enlightenment theory. That's what happened all over Europe. Did Jews embrace that idea? In the West, did they? Did they embrace public schooling?
Yes.
Yeah. Because what was the quid pro quo in the West?
Advancement.
Advancement. Meaning if you actually do this, you can go to Latin school, Harvard College, end up with that big house in West Newton. So people kind of intuitively got, like, that's a good bargain. Like, that's a bargain worth pursuing. In the East, did the quid pro quo hold there? How come? At some level, you're being asked to give up the same kinds of things around cultural difference, but what's the other side in the East? You don't have the social mobility. So that's a crucial divider, right? In other words, in the West, people feel like, yes, okay, so absolutely, I want to go to German university. I want to learn good German. Germany's a highly, you know, dynamic society, just like America, just like England. Those are moves I'm willing to make because rationally I sense that if I make those moves, the society will kind of open up to me. And the society itself is dynamic. A lot of stuff I can do. Russia is so backwards that people feel like, hey, you know what? Revolution of rising expectations. I mean, this is, and by the way, this is not irrelevant to some of the energy around the Arab Spring. Right? You have all these kids who are better educated, but these are still crappy societies with very small middle class capacities. Where are you going to find jobs for all these kids who've been to university? You don't have the capacity for it. So that's a huge problem. Like you can't, this is a part of the whole conversation around what it means to re-engineer societies. Like if you're going to do that, you got to create enough capacity that will sort of grow apace with stuff like educational advancement. So this is a part of the conversation in Russia. So most Jews, I mean, Russia is complicated because most Jews, number one, are used to living in places with critical mass of Jews. A lot of Jews in the shtetlach. So they have a kind of a linguistic, cultural, religious, national identity that's very different from the Western model. Like they really think of themselves as a people apart. Right? They talk Yiddish to each other. Number two, they look down on the goyim. Right? In other words, they have a sense of cultural superiority
that you don't see in the West. In the West, Jews have a sense of, oh, you know what, I'm a Jew, I'm a little bit embarrassed about that. I would like to become the Goyish partner. I'd like to dress like him, smell like him, I'd like to eat with my, drink tea with my pinky out. Like, they have a sense of embarrassment about backward Jewish customs. In the East, does Hevia want to be like a Goy? His attitude is, you know what? The Goy is illiterate. The Goy has bad teeth. The Goy is unhygienic. Like, there are all these stereotypes that Jews, like, we laugh now, but some of us actually grew up in houses where you would hear this is Jewish table talk. To use a good Yiddish phrase, entre new Jewish table talk. Right? Oh, a shikar is a Goy. What does that mean? Non-Jews drink. These are Eastern European stereotypes. Jews looked down on Goy, and they thought, you know what? We have this beautiful, amazing tradition. Every Jew is literate. Jews have the Torah. Jews study. They didn't have any sense of cultural aspiration, like, my goal was to become a Russian. So these were barriers to this integrationist thing that Nicholas I was trying to sort of foist upon them. Number one, Jews were separate demographically, lots of Jews. No, they weren't isolated and vulnerable. Number two, they culturally looked down on Goyim. And number three, no middle class. So why would you start eating the non-kosher blini? Right? All these yummy Russian foods. Why would you start eating that stuff? What are you going to get out of it? You're going to become a professor at Moscow State University? It's never going to happen. You're going to become an artist like Pushkin or Dostoevsky? It's never going to happen. So the whole sense, and you're going to become like a nice, you know, partner in Foley Hoag and live in a big house in West Newton? That's never going to happen. So why would you make all these trade-offs around identity when you think that I'm chasing after a bunch of scarce goods and services that are so scarce I'm never going to get them? So when Nicholas I tries to sort of get Jews to go en masse into these schools, he only peels off a tiny minority. You know, a few thousand, tens of thousands, whatever. Not huge, huge numbers. But out of these people comes whom? Well, no. What out of them comes Russian Jewish enlightened people. They are like the vanguard of what they hoped would be a kind of a liberalization of Russia. Dan, did you have a comment? Can I miss you? Somebody over here?
I was just going to ask about the town of settlement. Was that actually, is that sort of the state of, I've heard the term.
Yeah.
Is that like a state of mind? Or was
no, it's a real place. It's a real place with boundaries. Pale of Settlement is founded in the early 19th century, and most Jews live inside the Pale. You needed special papers. You know, like Robert Kraft, he should live and be well. Like, rich merchants could get papers to move to St. Petersburg. Most Jews could not do that. But by the way, that was not so unusual. Russia is an autocracy. People didn't have rights. They had privileges. The Tsar gave people privileges. The Jews were not the only people who suffered from disabilities. Everybody suffered from a disability being Russian. So, all right, Nicholas I, the bad Tsar, dies. He's succeeded by his son, Alexander II. They had some base 10 problems in Russia. We'll leave that. There actually was an Alexander I, but... So Alexander II becomes the Tsar in 1855. He is seen as a kind of a liberalizing Tsar. He's the one who frees the serfs, right? The serfs were this kind of landed class of peasants that were kind of literally kind of chained to the land. They weren't chattel slaves in the way that black slaves in America were. But the point is they were bonded labor in a very real way. And people, you know, this is also very funky in terms of the timing of it. This happening at the same time that Lincoln is freeing the slaves. So there's this kind of transatlantic sense of excitement about, oh, you know what, there's a kind of a revolution in labor relations. There's a revolution of liberalism.
And these Russian Jewish liberals are pretty bullish about, you know what, maybe Russia will become more like Germany and France. That turns out not to be the case, meaning that things liberalize, but only up to a point. And things sort of stagnate. And most Russian Jewish liberals end up becoming much more Russified than Jewish. And then you have what Eric brought to us, namely that Alexander II is assassinated in 1881. Why is he assassinated? He's assassinated by people who are frustrated that he wasn't radical enough, he wasn't liberal enough, wasn't progressive enough. He's assassinated by a kind of a radical populist group. And in the wake of that, what happens, some version of what Wendy and Eric talked about happens, namely, there are these outbreaks of anti-Jewish violence. Not really clear why. The government did not sponsor these things. The government was really not supportive of violence because it's an autocracy, by definition, it saw disorder as a problem. But it also didn't really do much to stop it. Most Jews, and this goes back to this whole issue of expectations, most Jews, of course, felt like, look, you know what, there have been pogroms before. Okay, never. It's a pity. The people who are really traumatized are the liberals. Because they are the ones who had felt like, you know what, maybe Russia is really in a process of progressivization, liberalization. Pinsker is one of those guys. He's a doctor. Probably doesn't even know Yiddish. His father already had been a kind of a liberal. He had served as a doctor in the Russian army in the Crimean War in the 1850s. So he's pretty successful as Jews go. He's got status. He's a medical professional, served in the army, which is, if you remember your 19th century literature, the officer class in all these armies are always like the non-Jews. That's part of the backstory to the Dreyfus thing later on as well. Like, it's a big thing for a Jew to be in the officer corps. Right? So he is kind of processing his kind of confusion and angst about what does this mean? What should we do now? Okay. So with that by way of introduction, remember, he's a doctor. Doctors like to do, yes, tell me your problem. And then I will suggest a therapeutic protocol in response. Okay, so what's the problem of the Jews, according to him? Yeah? Pam?
They have no nationalistic feelings for themselves. It's bad enough if other people, the Gentiles, don't see that they have, but he says they don't even have their own. No characteristic of national.
Is that the symptom or the disease? That's great that you see, you're exactly right.
I think it's both. I mean, they're in all these different places, so they're not national, and so they've begun to see themselves as not having any access. So I think it's almost cyclical.
Okay, good. Yeah, Peter?
They can't assimilate.
They how come they can't assimilate?
He used the term
Judeophobia. Right. Why can't they assimilate?
People don't accept it.
Why not?
They're different.
Why? How so? Yeah.
They're the quote unquote chosen people. There's a Jewish ghost in their past.
Okay. Right. He talks about the ghost thing. He likes playing with that sort of specter. Pardon the pun. Yep. Eric. Yeah.
He talks about there being an oversaturation of Jews. It's the number of Jews. If there were not that many, they may be able to assimilate.
Yes.
There's just too many.
Too many. Certainly in the Tsarist Empire, for sure that's true. They're much more like materially, they're empirically observable. That's a huge issue.
And they just can't be tolerated in those numbers.
Okay. So maybe there's like a book of Exodus, like there's just too many of them, it just freaks out non-Jews. Some kind of critical mass tipping point thing going on there. Yeah, Dan, and then we'll swing back around. Yeah?
Since they have no state they come from, since they're stateless, they're not, you can't trust them It's not like a normal farmer.
Okay. So now you're getting, now that's getting more subtle and interesting. At some level, to say that they aren't like other people, because in fact, in material reality, they are not like other people, he's beginning to say, what about the nature of anti-Semitism? Is it like, normatively speaking, an immoral thing? No. There is a kind of like a naturalistic, organic quality to it. We are too many. We do stand out. We're not like other people. We don't have a state of our own. And therefore, when people kind of glom onto us, they apprehend us, what do they see?
We're different.
And what does that generate in them in terms of reaction formation? What does that generate? Yeah, it's like why wouldn't you think they're weird? Like, there's something kind of intuitive about this. So that's a real problem. Some of it is demographic. Some of it is cultural, because how is it that we are different? It going back to the whole national v. non-national thing? What do we lack that everybody else has? We're not from anywhere. We are like the stranger, you know, Hollywood screenwriters always talk about, like, there are only a couple of basic models of, you know, screenplays. Like, one is the stranger who comes to town kind of thing. We are the stranger that comes to town. Like, where are we from? We're from nowhere. We're from everywhere. Like, what the hell does that even mean? It's weird.
So does it work in America because no one's from here?
Yes. That is right. That is the fabulous insight, Wendy. That is the great difference maker that is America. Here, nobody cares where you're from. Nobody's from anywhere. And that's totally great. That's an amazingly liberating kind of a thing.
But it is interesting that people will say, I'm a Jewish American, I'm an Italian American. You don't hear people say, I'm a Catholic American. You're always a national, except for Jewish people.
Yes, and in America, in a kind of a weird way, you have the ability, therefore the privilege, or the possibility of, in effect, reappropriating a national identity, precisely because here, at some level, it means nothing. Like, you could say, yes, I'm an Italian-American, and I eat this, and you eat that, and let's have a block party, we'll all bring, you know, a piece of our cuisine kind of thing. Like, who cares? There's no political consequence to that, really. So, yeah, Pam.
But the Jews still had this spiritual feeling, and it was kind of scary to
right.
The Gentiles.
We right.
How can you be if you don't have a country and you don't have a nation, then why are you still here?
Yes. Yes, it is the kind of the materiality, non-materiality that is so weird. Right? Clearly we do have certain core values and behaviors. There's a stickiness to Jewish life that he's not a Jewy Jew, but he gets the fact that most of the Jews he knows are. Like, he knows that about Jewish life in the Soviet, in Tsarist Russia. So that's the weirdness, right? In other words, they're not from anywhere. They should therefore be assimilable. And yet they're not, because they insist on being different, and yet they're not different in the conventional way of being like a Greek or a Turk or whatever, because they're not from anywhere. The Greek person in Greek diaspora has a sense of, oh, but I'm from Greece. The Jew isn't from Jewland, wherever that is, you know, land of Israel, whatever. And by the way, in very practical terms, right? He says, look, and this goes back to the original conversation about, you know, you brought up, Kent, about sort of the violent or the somewhat aggressive nature of nationalism. Okay, you put a French guy and a German guy in the same room. They gonna like each other?
No, the French guy is going to think, oh, God, all this schnitzel, like, you're killing me with all this crappy sausage. Like, you know, you have no taste for our fine sauces. You know, our language is so much more beautiful. It's so much more sonorous than yours. Like, there's all kinds of ways in which these countries will kind of battle with each other around cultural stuff, historical stuff, blah, blah, blah. But is there a baseline of respect? How come? They're both countries. Like, they both have a sense of, like, okay, so I look down on German cuisine, but I still get the fact Germany's like a real place. Right? Where do the Jews fit into that? They're not. They're not equal. They're not players in this game. They're everywhere and nowhere. They don't even have a real place of their own. That's the whole, and by the way, this is a part of the backstory to Abram's, you know, Avram, or however you pronounce his first name, Sacher, the first president of Brandeis. When he wrote his autobiography, he called it A Host at Last. Because Pinsker says the Jews can never fulfill what crucial social role that would make them accepted by non-Jews. They can never be hosts. How do you feel about the person you invite to your house all the time, they never invite you? You say, hey, what the hell is this? Like, I made a brisket for them a million times, they can't make me a brisket once? Like, what's up with that? I mean, you have Rachmanis on them, maybe. You say, oh, it's terrible, they had financial reversals, they can't cook, the stove is broken. Like, you could make excuses for them, but on some level, you would feel like, you know what, I sort of have put them in a different category because they're sort of, like, not equal to me. It's a terrible thing to be a guest all the time and never to be a host. That's the backstory to the pride that American Jews felt about the founding of Brandeis University. That's why Sacher titled the book that. It's a wonderful thing to be able to host people. So this is part of what he's saying, which is, number one, we are weird. Number two, this is what it looks like, and these are the repercussions, which is people justly sort of freak out around this non-hosty thing. And number three, the very first thing Pam said, which is the most important insight of all, what's the deepest Jewish problem? When you try to have a kind of an intervention with them, you know, you bring in the social worker and the whole team of people who say, like, hey, man, don't you recognize how weird and dysfunctional you are? What is the Jewish response? Huh? But wait, it's in the Torah. It's a part of history. It's about a prophetic Jeremiah thing that we're supposed to be in exile. And the social worker just sort of, like, crosses the name off the list, says, I'm going to go on to the next patient, like somebody I can actually help. Right? That's basically what he says. The real problem of the Jews, and this is the most famous line in there, they're like the sick patient who is, what does he say? Who denies they're sick. There's nothing wrong with me. They're resisting treatment. They don't see it. And that therefore suggests that what ultimately is the problem of the Jews, according to Pinsker. Yeah?
Lack of self-respect.
And self-awareness about lack of self-respect. It's like, it's a doubling. It's a lack of self-respect, we don't get how weird we are, and we've made actually a virtue out of a necessity, or a virtue out of a pathology, even worse. Right? This is, I hate to say it, but I know this from personal experience. This is the alcoholic before you kind of break through, and they realize, you know what, I'm sick. I have a problem, I've got to deal with it. Right? The person who resists treatment is a very sick person indeed. Because not only do you have to deal with the problem, but you have to deal with the extent to which they compound the problem by resisting the therapy. That's a very, very sick person. This is what he's saying about the Jews. Now, of course, how is this a radical diagnosis of anti-Semitism? Because ultimately, what is he really saying, therefore, about anti-Semitism? Yeah, Dan?
It's justified.
Yeah, at some level it's justified. Number two, is it even really the problem at the end? No. What's the real problem?
The Jews.
The Jews. That is why, in my judgment, this is the single most important essay. Single most important sort of paradigm
shifter in Zionist thought. Because at the end, what he's really saying is, stop worrying about what the goyim think of you. And stop blaming the goyim for what's wrong with you. This goes back to Baron's thing about ghetto and emancipation. He says, you know what? Start solving your own problems. Where does the revolution begin? In your head. Start thinking about your life differently, and once you start doing that, all other things are possible. If you cannot do that, it will probably prevent you from doing all pretty much anything you want to do. This, of course, we recognize from our own lives, our lives as parents, whatever, which is basically, hey, you know what? The beginning of a moral life is the and a productive life is the idea that actions have consequences and you are responsible. The person who cannot learn that is going to have a very difficult time being productive in their life, in any sphere, emotionally, professionally, what have you. The person who gets that, you know, everything is open to them. Because they're accountable in some deep way. And that's really what he is saying Jews have got to do to themselves, which is to figure out how to become accountable. You know, how to become accountable for your history, how to become accountable for your culture, how to become accountable for your politics. If you continue to see this as the Jew is victim, bad news. Once a victim, always a victim. He, again, does he have an interest in Jewish culture? Not so much. That's because, again, that's not the kind of Jew he was. But how did the first Aliyah, and we'll end here, how did the first Aliyah grow out of this worldview? Right? Did you look at the text in the Penzlar? Right? How did it grow out of this sort of like meta worldview that says, you know, it's about self-responsibility, about accountability taking, stock taking, the intellectual, mental, existential revolution of realizing there's something wrong with us, we've got to change it. How did the first Aliyah express that? What did these guys do? Yeah, they moved. Were they productive on a sort of like capacity building infrastructure level? No, total failures. Like totally ridiculous, pretty much. They tried. They build towns, right? They build you know, again, we're New Englanders, so we should appreciate this. They had a sense of they were kind of town builders, like the Puritans. Right? They weren't anti-traditional. Right? If you can look at these charters of these towns, they said, oh, we're going to govern ourselves by the Shulchan Aruch. Right? These are not like the hardcore crazy socialists, right, violently pushing back against Jewish tradition. That's not who these guys are. That's the second and third Aliyah. Only, you know, how many came, if you read the Penzlar introduction? Yeah. You know, tens of thousands. Not huge numbers. Mostly from small towns. Had no clue what they were doing. These were mostly university people or a little bit older. They come in families. They want to build these traditional towns. Yifron Yaakov, Rishon LeZion, other places. Almost totally dependent upon the largesse of funders, right? The Rothschilds, etc. The Rothschilds that you saw, some of the pushback, like, we want you to grow silk. You know, we want to, you know, here, we're going to send you an agronomist from the finest school in Paris. He's going to tell you what to do. So there's a lot of passive-aggressive energy around, like, are we really independent or not? Right? It took them a really long time to get off the ground in terms of capacity stuff. So, not very successful in terms of creating a kind of a there. But the World Jewish Press covered these people. And people were excited about this kind of like, these people are taking their lives in their own hands. They're going back to the land of Israel. They're trying. And by the way, what's the sort of the mythic
I mean, we talked about this when we looked at the poster images. What's the sort of the valence of, you know, they're going back to the land, they're building towns, however dysfunctional they may have been?
Pride.
And physicality, like they're farmers. Jews typically weren't farmers. So they don't make a huge fuss around that in terms of the iconography. It's a little bit early for that. That's really much more of a 20th century phenomenon. But people did have a sense of pride that these people were, there was a kind of a romantic sense of back to the land and at least trying to sort of rebuild the Jewish self. Not successful, but an interesting beta, I would say. And that then becomes the action to which Herzl reacts, which you will see in the novel. He will see, yeah, they did some things right. It's nice, the pride piece, but as a plan for actually building a Jewish state, a total non-starter. But he derives a certain kind of learning from their mistakes, and that's always important, too, of course. I missed somebody here. Yeah, Dan?
Yeah, I was fascinated by the different mindsets of different people.
Yeah.
Used to being peddlers, used to having to do this. The whole thing of a funder and people working for a funder, you know, who, where they're not actually carrying their own weight, and how that works or doesn't work.
Yeah.
Comparing it to startups today with VC money and stuff like that. Also the thing about how socialism versus hiring the average low
yes.
wage. The whole thing about the low wage, that little section about the low
right.
wages.
Yeah.
And how by being all together in socialism, that's how they could deal with
right.
the fact of low pay. That was fascinating.
Right. Well, are these guys socialists in the sort of doctrinaire sense? No, they're really not. I mean, they do have a sense of they need to pool things together because they lack, again, it's about pooling enough capital that you can sort of do stuff, and that also goes back to the funding thing. But the, let's talk about the Arab thing. What's that argument about? The role of Arabs in this piece. I mean, it's again, it's not super politicized at this point. It's much more of a kind of a cultural, spiritual argument. As much as it is just about politics. Like, there's not, like, a Jewish-Arab conflict so much at this point.
They were learning from them.
Well, number one, they're learning some stuff from them. But also, what's the issue around Arab labor?
It's cheaper.
So, again, if you're thinking, look, you know what, I am struggling. I mean, you know this with the history of all colonies, the famous thing with Roanoke, right, James? I mean, you know, in other words, it's hard to be a colony. Like, you don't really know what you're doing. There's no guarantee that your colony's going to survive. So, obviously, one, you know, old-fashioned mathematics, the numerator or the denominator, like, if you're freaking out about your business plan, you either say, I got to have more revenue, or I got to cut costs. Your biggest fixed cost is your labor. So it's an intuitive economic move to make to say, well, you know what, are we being optimally efficient around labor? That's where you get the Arab calculation thing coming in. What's the argument against Arab labor? Well, you might generate some pushback. And you're not doing it yourself. So this, in turn, will also become a very big conversation from Aliyah 1 to Aliyah 2. The Aliyah 2 people will be much more totally focused on this, what they call in Hebrew, Avodah Ivrit. Jews have to do all the work. I will tell you just parenthetically, I hope you'll come with me to hear this yourself. We went to visit people in the West Bank who were very annoyed, this is a few years ago, that Arabs, that part of the push inside of Palestinian nationalism was not to work for Jews. And this person said to me, you know, I'm so frustrated and upset about this because we always had this very nice arrangement where, you know, like the Jews were the contractors and Ishmael was the guy kind of laying the tile and the brick sort of thing. I felt like I was inside of Driving Miss Daisy, but whatever.
Like the black guy is the chauffeur and the white lady sits behind in the back seat. She says this without a trace of irony or self-awareness. I said, well, gee, it sounds a little bit to me kind of like Zionism. Like, hey, if you really want to be free, you got to be willing to do all the work, including like cleaning the toilets and laying the tile. She totally didn't get that. But the point is that that's a historical kind of argument inside of Zionism about, you know, do you have cultural values around stuff like self-determination and self-worth around Jews do all the work? And or do you have a much more sophisticated kind of economic business plan metric piece that says, look, I couldn't care about any of that stuff. My only focus is on what is going to be the best economic model for growing this thing. In which case, you might come down on the side that says, look, it's better for us to hire Arabs. It's a better use of our capital. You know, that's a, I leave that to much smarter business people than myself. But that's that argument you saw in these texts goes really back all the way to the beginning. Yeah, Peter.
I just had a question about the migration. The article pointed out that 500,000 Jews went to the U.S.
Yeah.
And 30,000 went to Palestine. Is there any backstory to that? Are these like a certain subset?
What's the backstory? Who are the weirdos who go who don't go to, you know, Cleveland and Boston and all these other and said Cape Town and all these other places? Like, why? How do you differentiate between these wackos and everybody else? Some of it is like the pull piece, like if you were lucky enough to have somebody sending you money to come to Cape Town or wherever. But what is the artificial selection mechanism that would lead a person to end up in Zichron Yaakov as opposed to Boston? What's the difference?
Religious conviction that you belong to the land, you gotta come back to the land.
Religious and or national. Right, the person who is going to Boston is not thinking in national terms about solving the problem of the Jewish people. The person who's going to Zichron Yaakov is. I mean, that to me is sort of. And by the way, so again, you going long on that stock? You going long on the nationalist stock? Look at the numbers. Peter, you just picked up on it. It's a loser. It's a dog. It's a dog of a stock. Most Jews are not doing it. Most Jews are going to New York or Cleveland or wherever. No, look, over 100,000 Jews a year go to New York in this period. Zionists would have killed to have 100,000 Jews. You don't get that number until Hitler. And even then, you don't get 100,000 coming a year. So, no, Zionism does not win in terms of capturing the hearts and minds. Like, we cry over it. We go to the Friends of IDF dinner, and we eat, you know, Franks and blankets for them, and this and that. But the point is, we don't support it. We support it, but we don't live it. That's a harsh truth. Yeah, Nancy?
I don't really remember, because I read it.
And then we'll stop, yeah.
Summer, but the Shapira book,
Anita,
remember a part where she said that not only was it very fluid, the coming and going, that might have been later, I don't know, but that there was a period of time that the more Jews weren't even wanted because they were so poor and they couldn't feed.
The capacity issue.
If someone couldn't really contribute,
yes.
They were
yes.
Short.
You'll see a text in here after World War I, we'll look at it in a couple of weeks, where the guy says, and again in this incredibly non-PC way, you know, oh yeah, we want the HBS engineer guy. Like, we don't want Tevye. Tevye can't do much for us. Bricklin can do something. He can make the spreadsheet for us. That we can do. Right? We need smart guys. We need very focused social capital, engineers, builders, doctors, agronomists. Couldn't care less about Tevye. First, we need these guys to build the engines, and then Tevye will come and provide the sweat equity. But you can't mess with that sequence, because if you mess too much with that sequence, you end up with a very poor, backward society, and the Jews didn't have enough money to support that. So absolutely, like there's a lot of very hard conversations around, you know, how many Bricklands and how many Debbies. And that's a very important conversation to have, and they have it. Absolutely. Okay, any questions or comments? Now that I embarrassed you, Dan, I outed you. I'm sorry. But it's absolutely true. Like, these guys were super hard-headed about wanting the best and the brightest to come. Absolutely. Anita was right about that. Yeah, Dan?
They have very little about the people who were already there.
Yeah.
The relatives who were there for generations and generations.
Yes. The old issue, and who are they?
And even then, the support they broke into Ashkenaz, and then even
that's right. You have the old religious Jews living in places like Hebron, Tiberias, Jerusalem, Spot, but they basically dismiss them because they, being a social capital, they're like old Jews who are just there being religious. And they're not going to add anything.
Both the Sephardi and the Ashkenazi?
Yeah, mostly the Ashkenazi.
Yeah, so they don't talk about the Sephardi.
Yeah.
It's a very Ashkenazi-centered, myopic view of things, for sure. That's true. Any last words about the first Aliyah? Yeah, Jen?
In Zichron Yaakov, it's the museum to the Aliyah.
Yes.
And in there are these burlap bags with the names of the towns on them. And when I went in there, I asked it to send what they were. And when Rothschild died, every town sent an emissary with a bag of the dirt from their town to put in the grave.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there is a very tactile sense of connection to these people, as complicated as those relations were. Thank you for sharing that. All right, so guys, have a happy Thanksgiving. And I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thank you very much. Enjoy Old New Land.